On behalf of Torrin Motion, I want to thank the Debate Adult Education Committee for all their work and for their partnering with us in presenting what we hope will be a very inspiring and a thoughtful program this evening. And tomorrow, I want to thank the Rav of the Shul, and I want to thank all of you for coming. Parshat Bo, of course, is the Parsha on Pesach and the Parsha of children. The whole Seder and the whole Parsha, Leman Tisaper, we should tell our children, Veigadata, Lebincha, again to tell our children, of course, all the questions. Three of the four children, you know, so to speak, are found in the Parsha. So this is the ideal Parsha, really, to talk on children. And, of course, when we talk about talking to our children, we're not so much talking on teaching our children, it's really answering the questions. We know that the whole Seder revolves around questions and answers. And, of course, in our religion, questions are more important than answers. And we don't always have the answers to all the questions. That's the work we have to put into what we do. But the question is very important. And if we do not allow and encourage questioning, I think it'll be very difficult. It is difficult to pass on our way of life to the next generation. And this is really what this mini-conference is all about. I think we entitled the panel, The Return to Questioning. The answers are less important. Hopefully we will raise, over the course of the panel and tomorrow morning, we'll raise a series of questions. And the answers you're going to have to think about. And we want to give you lots of food for thought. It's a very complex issue, and we're going to begin the evening with a short film as on three prominent daughters in three prominent families in Israel who are not following exactly in the path of their parents. You'll see, and we'll begin the film and we'll continue with our panel discussion. Thank you very much. I'm left almost speechless. Really, I found that extremely powerful, as I'm sure many of you also did, all of you. We are bringing in a few more chairs, so for those who are standing, I think off to my right, we'll be having a few more chairs, and we'll start the panel in a couple moments. Thank you.
All right. Good evening. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamud. I'm the co-founder of Torrin Motion, and along with my colleagues, Rabbi Jay and Mrs. Alana Kelman, I'd like to welcome you to another Torrin Motion panel discussion. There are several people I wanted to thank. Jay has thanked some of them already, but I especially wanted to express my gratitude to Einat Kapach of the Mahle Film School in Jerusalem. I went to visit the school last month, and I'd contacted her a couple of months ago to acquire a copy of The Rabbi's Daughter, which was only available in limited screening online. And she was very gracious, and I went and visited the school, and they're doing wonderful work, and it's because of her that we watched the film tonight, so thank you very much to Einat. As this is our first ever full conference at BIED, I'd like to thank the spiritual leader, Harav Daniel Karapkin, for his unstinting support, and to the members... to the members of the BAIT Education Committee for their very hard work in facilitating this program. All right, let's get to it. I have never been terribly happy with the term off the derech. It implies one derech, one path, and you're either on it or you're not. And it seems to me there may be various paths that connote service to God. And we do not have accurate statistical data about how many people drop out of a Jewish life. But it is clear that there are defections from observance within the Jewish community and various states of alienation in all denominations. So tonight we'd like to begin to talk about how our children relate to Torah, how our education system, thank you, is faring in this regard, what is going wrong and what is going right in terms of our efforts to transmit Judaism to the next generation. So we thank you for joining us. I'm going to introduce our speakers. Please hold your applause until I've introduced them all. To my immediate left, Rabbi Daniel Karapkin is the Mora D'Atra of Beit, received his rabbinic ordination from Near Israel Rabbinical College in Baltimore. He received his MA in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA's Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures and his Master of Science degree from Johns Hopkins School for Engineering at the Applied Physics Laboratory. Before moving to CAD in 2011, he was Rosh Kehila, the spiritual community leader of Yavne in Los Angeles, and he's the author of a translation of the classic philosophical work, The Kuzari. On the end, Rav Yaakov Horowitz is the founder and dean of Yeshiva Darche Noam of Muncie. He's also the founder and director of the Center for Jewish Family Life Project, YES, a national parenting organization which conducts numerous programs designed to promote family stability in the Jewish community. He's recently published, in conjunction with Art Scroll, a children's personal safety picture book, Let's Stay Safe, and it's available on sale in the lobby. Rabbi Horowitz has received numerous accolades for his work, including several awards, among them the Greenspoon Steinhardt Award for Excellence in Jewish Education. On the left, Ms. Leah Malamud holds a master's in clinical psychology from the University of Toronto, is currently completing her doctorate in clinical psychology. She's been a psychotherapist for 30 years, and her work includes individual treatment of children, adolescents, and adults, and extensive experience with the Orthodox Jewish population throughout the spectrum. Ms. Malamud has worked in Toronto at CAMH, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, Clark Institute of Psychiatry, Credit Valley Hospital, and the Hinks-Delcrest Center, and has spoken internationally on the topics of orthodoxy and mental health and Judaism and psychology. To my immediate right, Ari Margolis, a native of Dallas, Texas, is currently studying on the Young Judea Year course in Israel. He's written several articles and personal essays exploring his motivations and experiences in going off the derech, including a widely lauded piece in Tablet magazine that first brought him to my attention, entitled Taking Off My Tefillin. His work is available at arimargolis.com. Please welcome our speakers. We're going to begin by asking Rav Karapkin, and I've told everybody that everybody can jump in on any question. And just two announcements. One, please turn off your cell phones or turn them to quiet. And secondly, we will have a question period from the audience at the end, so do not worry. The terms off the derech and kids at risk are often blurred together in less than helpful ways. Sometimes kids at risk is used to describe children who leave Torah observance, but at other times the very same phrase depicts kids who have a drug or alcohol problem and even engage in criminal acts. These are very different situations. I can easily conceive of someone being non-observant and being very well adjusted. Isn't it possible that kids who leave Judaism do so because they simply don't buy into the package that observance entails? Couldn't a child be well-loved and simply say, no, religion is not for me? So isn't it misleading to constantly conflate kids who reject observance with kids who engage in harmful behaviors by calling both of them at risk?
That's for me.
Well, he'll start.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Malamud and Rabbi and Mrs. Kelman and all of our panelists. We're delighted to be able to share in this event with Torah in Motion. I hate going first on a panel. I like to digest what everyone else is saying and then come up with something profound at the end. But be that as it may, let me... The question is, are we unfairly and inappropriately conflating off the derech with kids at risk? Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Malamud, that those labels, to me, are they've become hackneyed and cliched. So we probably would be best served not to use those terms unless, I guess, we want to speak clinician to clinician in a way that we do to express in a shorthand fashion what really is quite complex. Why then is why are those two terms sometimes put together? That is an unfortunate product of the perception that when a child from an Orthodox home leaves the faith, then not only have they left religion, but they have fallen into a horrible abyss. And therefore, for some families, a child becoming not frum is as bad or worse than a child who's on heroin. When in reality, one behavior is self-destructive and could lead potentially to the loss of that child's life, or God forbid, or just falling into a horrible kind of life. And the other is a lifestyle choice which may potentially lead to a very happy and successful individual who happens not to be Orthodox. I wish I could say that we live in a world where every single child should be an Orthodox Jew if they grow up in an Orthodox family. But the reality is simply not that way. Here in our community, and it's not unique to our community, my perception is that if you have a family of five children, then the chances are excellent that one of those five will not be from. I believe that that's true statistically, and that's why when you heard the young lady say 1 in 8, not bad, I was nodding my head. Yeah, that's a great statistic. 7 out of 8 kids brought up in a from home today remaining from is an excellent statistic based just upon my anecdotal experience. Because there are so many things that are pulling at our children's minds and hearts, despite our best efforts, despite our placing them in the finest yeshivot and seminaries, that are going to invariably affect our children, no matter what kind of filters and separations and borders that we try to place for them. I think that there's a certain amount of guilt that's healthy sometimes when we think about what did I do wrong to cause my child to leave the faith, but there's an even greater amount of guilt that's unhealthy because there are certain times when, despite our best efforts, our children made life decisions as either young adults or adults where they decided that they were not going to be from, despite the fact that we might have done everything right. There may be a number of different social factors and psychological factors that go into a young man or a young woman's choice in life to decide that despite the fact that I grew up in this home and despite the fact that I'm disappointing my parents and despite the fact that I'm leaving my social circle where I feel a sense of comfort, I've decided to make a life decision to leave the faith. It's beyond my pay grade. I don't know what the reason is. Just tell me how much, what the time limit is.
We'll come back. I just want to frame the question a little more specifically for you, Rabbi Horowitz. There's all sorts of theories that get bandied about for why people become more or less attached to their Jewish observance. I've been in education for 25 years. I heard a lot of them. I'm wondering, in your experience, there's a sort of argument out there, is it emotional, is it intellectual? In other words, do kids become disaffected because they don't like the answers they got in school about specific questions? Or is it something on a much more visceral, emotional level where simply the people that they associate with religion, be it their parents or people at school, were not loving, were not warm, alienated them? It had much less to do with some sort of intellectual discussion about, you know, does God exist, and much more, you weren't nice to me in the third grade. I'm wondering, from your experience, how does it seem to you?
Shavuot Tov, everyone. Thank you for coming, and thank you for having me on the panel. In ADD, in attention deficit disorder, there's a ADHD and just plain ADD. ADD is without the hyperactivity. That it's often referred to as a sleeper form of ADD. In other words, a child is having difficulty concentrating with no hyperactivity. It's generally not noticed that much because the kid is sitting in class and not disturbing anyone. Now, the H, with the hyperactivity, it's the same ADD, just with a lot of motion and Torah in motion. Okay, I do well. I think in this term, if I won't use off the derech, I think we have really, it's a very similar phenomenon. In other words, you have kids who are off the derech with the H, you know, with the hyperactivity, very angry, very rebellious, very very upset, often coming with trauma of one sort or another, which we were speaking about Friday night, whether it's abuse or other issues or just a negative experience. And very often there is a significant kickback and pushback from the child or children. And then in that time, they're leaving it's an act. They're leaving. And very often you have off the derech without the hyperactivity. And you really, it's a much more subtle form. And typically the kids who leave and without the hyperactivity, it's generally more of a thoughtful decision that comes over a period of time. Mostly, it's not that they're leaving, that they're not engaged, or they haven't been engaged properly, or very often, there were issues that were gnawing at them over a period of time that were never really addressed. They never had the opportunity to ask significant questions that are really on their minds. And that's why I think, I think one of the possible outcomes, I think it's helpful to have this discussion, although, everybody got a lot of feedback over Shabbos one way and the other. I think it's helpful to do this. If you're interested, I wrote an article in Mishpacha magazine about 6 years ago called Exit Interviews. And I wrote, I was actually at a conference with a number of of Jews who were not observant. Quite a few of them came from Hamish homes, modern Orthodox homes, and yeshivish, chassidish homes, really across the board. And I wrote the article the next week saying, when you cancel a credit card, they call you and say, why'd you cancel? I think it's so valuable, it's so important. We may not like to hear it, you might be upset about it, but listening to the kids, I speak to a kid who's off the derech, I listen to them. I like to find out. It's very important, very valuable for me to know this. I think it's valuable to the parents to know this. I think we need to have a vibrant and serious, thoughtful discussion about the issue because it is very important. And I think all of us will gain from having this discussion. Thank you.
I wanted to, bring in Ari and ask him, based on what I was just talking about, like for you, as you were going through various processes and thinking about it, did your feelings about the matter stem mostly, would you say, from something sort of gut emotional, or was it something that you were thinking about consciously?
So I guess the popular thing to be doing now is to thank everyone who brought me here. So you'll start off by doing that. Thank you to Rabbi Malamitz, Dr. Malamitz, and the rabbi for finding me, bringing me out here, taking the tremendous risk of having an unproven speaker and teenager in front of a bunch of adults. Who knows what he could say, right?
There's the off switch here.
I know. So hopefully I'll do my best and slightly impress all of you or just leave you asking more questions. But also Rabbi Horowitz says you have to listen to me now, so just keep that in mind.
Oh, now I give a hexer.
So it's all his fault. That's what I mean. So the question is it more emotional or was it more rational, I guess? Well, first of all, I would like to claim to be the child mentioned earlier in the question about that I was the one who came from a loving home, never really had. I mean, I had my fair share of problems with Jewish education, which I'll discuss tomorrow. You all should be there, I guess. But, I mean, I had nothing extremely substantial enough that it would specifically drive me away from Judaism, which I, in fact, love very much for a very long time, and I still have a pretty fair amount of respect for it. Nothing very tremendous that it would completely drive me away from it. So I would like to say that it was purely purely objective and purely unemotional and rational. But it's really a hard question to answer because you never really know, and I don't think anyone really can. Like, I'll stand up here, I could give you reason upon reason upon reason, like philosophical views and psychological things about why my decision was purely rooted upon nothing more than science and reason and whatnot. But it's like I said, it's really impossible to tell for sure. No one could be as what I tried to do is I tried to look at everything as objective as possible and remove the subjectivity of it all from the question. And once I did that, I came up with the answer that Judaism, in my opinion, was not. Wouldn't say it's not for me. I mean, you guys all seem to be enjoying it very much, but it's not real for me. Like I can't stand up here and say that it's not valid. In my opinion, I don't think it's valid. So it's not like it wasn't for me. I just didn't think it was the real thing. So again, I looked at that and I would love to say that decision was all objectivity, but I guess you could all decide for yourself based on what I say if it really was.
So notwithstanding that there are certainly people who defect from a religious life for philosophical and intellectual reasons, they don't have to be considered off balance or not well adjusted. I certainly feel that there are plenty of such individuals. The part that I want to focus on is really the interface between psychology and religion. When thinking about kids going, quote, off the derech or doing things that are less than acceptable in the religious community, the question is always, what is masquerading as what? Are we talking about emotional issues that are showing up in terms of religious rebellion? Or are we talking about religious struggles that are being manifested emotionally? It's not an easy question to answer, but it's an important question to be asking, because you have to know what it is that you're looking at in the first place before you can decide how to address it. And so when we speak about the differences between the at-risk kid who's, you know, perhaps, you know, on drugs or alcohol versus the kid who's off the derech, clearly they're not the same thing, but they're not disconnected either sometimes, because if a child is feeling, for whatever reasons, inadequate, alienated, rejected, you can often have both happening at the same time. The reaction may be a retreat into some kind of drug culture because there's a feeling of soothing or belonging, and there also can be a defection from religion. The part that that I think is important to speak about, the word that comes to mind for me in terms of just healthy raising of kids and has relevance to healthy religious life, even for those who claim to be religious but maybe are not religious in a healthy way, is integration. One of the things, an example of, you know, where there might be emotional issues that translate religiously is authority. So you might have a kid who has difficulty with authority slash control. Either there's been too much of it or there's been too little of it in their lives. Essentially, if there's been too much, there may be a feeling that the child was not respected for being his or her individual self, that there was a box that he or she was expected to fit into. And essentially, the religious rebellion is really a comment on the way they feel received overall. There isn't sort of an ability to, or permission to integrate all of who they are. They've been told there's this box, we want you to be this way. Maybe certain emotions are acceptable and certain emotions are not. In this family, this school, whatever, we're okay with happy, enthusiastic, cooperative. We're not too into sad, anxious, depressed, angry, whatever. I mean, that might be the message. Or we accept this kind of behavior and not that kind of behavior. And the child doesn't feel like all of me is acceptable. So not only are they getting the message that I have to fit a certain box, but they also do not have the facility then to integrate all aspects of who they are, because essentially they're either being communicated or meta-communicated the message that some of you has to go underground. Now, if some of you has to go underground and is banished, then you're going to have another way to express it, because it doesn't disappear. It just goes underground, and it leaks out in some other way, which might, in fact, be a religious rebellion. You can have too little control, where kids feel like everything's possible, there are no limits, creates a lot of insecurity, haven't taught any kind of self-regulation. That's also a problem. And there are variations. I'm picking up on something that Rabbi Horowitz said. I mean, he was using it in a different context about ADHD. But there are also plenty of kids, and this has to do with a much larger topic of the emphasis in the Jewish community on head versus heart, text versus sort of body expression or chesed and so on, where the kids feel like we don't fit in this world. We don't relate to sitting and learning for hours at a time. We don't relate to religion or to God through text. Maybe we're a more artsy type. Maybe we have a learning disability. Maybe we have ADD, whatever it is. And these kids are subtly and not so subtly given the message that you really are not what we want. You're not really ever going to be what we want. And on some level, these kids feel like, I don't quite fit in the Jewish community, or at least the Jewish Orthodox community. And there are people out there in the either non-religious Jewish world or the Gentile world that think I'm terrific, you know, and I don't have to translate me into these other ways of being. And they feel quite accepted. So I'll just give you one example, and this is not an example of so much the artsy type, but so I saw a girl from many years ago from Beis Yaakov. Ostensibly she was coming because her parents, her teachers felt she was at risk for an eating disorder. So I was asking her the usual questions, kind of school, friends, whatever you would ask in the beginning. And she started to tell me about how she feels very different in class. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, the other day they were speaking about some machshava class, Jewish philosophy, and the teacher made this statement as a fact, the Gentile soul is inferior to the Jewish soul. Fact. And all the kids are busy writing their notes and then, you know, on to the next thing. And she's looking around like nobody's saying anything. Like, so she respectfully raises her hand and says, how do we know that? Seemed like a reasonable question, you know. And the teacher stared down at her and said, I think you have problems with your emunah. And that was the beginning and end of that conversation. Now, I tell this not to say this is all that goes on at Beis Yaakov. That isn't the point. The point is that in every school, there are answers that are being given. There are responses that kids are getting. There are ways that they are feeling that there is a box that I have to fit into. I don't usually get into religion unless somebody brings it up in the therapy. That's not my place. But I just asked the girl if she had looked into this topic on her own. She's a very bright girl. Did she research? She said, not yet. She said, why do you ask? I said, well, you might want to look at the Rambam. She said, why do you say that? I said, well, yeah, it seems that the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had differing views on the subject. And from where I sit, you've joined the conversation, you know, hundreds of years of the Jewish conversation, really. Well, she'd come into the session sort of sitting like this, quite dejected. And when I said that, she sat up, tossed her hair. Just the thought that she'd become part of this chain of Jewish tradition and that she, it was empowering. These are not the messages that are necessarily being given by parents, being given by the schools, that all of you can be embraced, your questions can be embraced. You don't have to banish them to underground so they leak out in all kinds of ways that you're not even in control of. So the topic of text versus spirit, head versus heart, we can talk about more later.
Well, Dr. Malamud has raised the issue. One of the causes of why some children leave the faith having to do with our educational system, and I guess I should just address that for a moment. First of all, thank you for giving a plug for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, even though he's on the other side of the argument.
Yeah.
But those who come to my Kuzari class know that I give equal time to the Rambam, and we discuss it. And this actually just came up in our shiur this past week, where one of the very thoughtful participants of the class said, after we had presented a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam on what happened at Maimed Har Sinai, asked the question, but you're confusing us, and you're not providing us with one specific derech as far as how we're supposed to view these things. And I said, precisely, that's what I'm here for. I said, when it comes to religious behavior, that's what Shlomo HaMelech says, Sof davar hakol nishma, esa elokim yirave es mitzvasav shemor kizeh kol ha'adam. That at the end of it, all of the analysis and all of the struggles and all of the inner turmoil that Shlomo HaMelech expresses in the book of Koheles, he says, but you know what? I am conflicted. I do have inner demons that and questions and contradictory statements that exist within one person. But that's all in the realm of thought. That's all in the realm of my theology and my ideology. But when it comes to the way I choose to live my life, I have to acknowledge that I have to revere God and do his mitzvahs because that's the totality of man. So we have a little bit of a difficulty here. And that's basically how I answered the question to this lady, is that Judaism is defined, at least, I'm sorry for Rav Yehuda Halevi at least, it's defined by how we express ourselves as Jews in the outside world, not how we express ideas to ourselves that are circulating in our mind. But even for Maimonides, he says quite explicitly that we don't say the halacha is like one opinion over the other when it comes to hilchot deot, when it comes to pure theological issues. The problem that we have, a challenge that we have in many of our yeshivot in our seminaries today, is that one of two things is taking place. Either there's the certain didactic, triumphant kind of attitude where this is our party line, this is what you have to accept, and anything outside of that is kfira. Anything outside of that is apostasy. This is, for some children, very confining. For some adults, it's very confining. And therefore, over the years, I've developed a voice that says that we have to be, when it comes to halachic practice, there's a Shulchan Aruch. When it comes to deot, when it comes to the theology of Judaism, we have to acknowledge and respect that doesn't begin and end with the Rambam. There is an extreme vast spectrum of acceptable theological positions that one can take. And if one of our children or one of the members of our community says, I find a certain thing that Maimonides says to be theologically problematic, we should not be ready to consign him to Gehenna and call him an apikoros. And the problem that we have in our schools sometimes is that our teachers lack the sufficient training in theological issues to be able to have that kind of attitude of, okay, let's talk about divergent opinions. There are different opinions on this matter. And even for this young lady, who the teacher obviously needed to get across a point. She wanted to get across a point, a certain theological idea that she felt was important. I'm not going to judge it for now. But if the girl had a problem with it, and the teacher felt that this was not appropriate, she didn't want at this stage of the girl's development to confuse the girls, she should have said, that's an excellent question. How do we know this? Please see me after class. But I'll bet you a donut that she couldn't give that answer because she didn't know that there were different opinions on the matter. I just spoke to a respected rabbi in this community who has his sons in a certain yeshiva in this community. He told me that his children who are in this yeshiva told him that their perception is that a full 50% of the boys in the yeshiva, and it's a very from yeshiva, walk the walk and talk the talk, but theologically they're out to lunch. In other words, they do what everyone else is doing, but they really don't believe in their hearts, not even in Hashem, and they don't necessarily even believe that what they're doing is of any significance. They go along with it because their parents tell them to, because their rebbeim refuse to discuss some of the serious issues, and they just say, Gemara, Gemara, Gemara. So they want to get good grades, and they don't want to get kicked out of school, and they don't want to be out on the street, and so they go along with the program. That's one of our problems.
I just want to say that I've been teaching a fourth-year seminar this year at university only on Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, and I've come to the conclusion there's not a single thing that he says that isn't theologically problematic. Not one. Rabbi Horowitz.
On that note, so about a year ago, a seventh grader in my yeshiva raises his hand, and he says, Rebbe, why do we have to learn all this stuff that the Tanaim, the sages of the Talmud, were talking about? Just tell me what the halacha is. Why do I need to know what they were arguing in the first place? So this Rebbe is a very bright individual, very charming, charismatic, and very wise. And he says, why don't you ask Rabbi Horowitz that? So this kid comes up to my office. And I was actually meeting with someone. He respectfully went. I said, no, come on up. This looks important. He says, well, I asked Rebbe, why do we, you know. So I said, well, sorry, pal. You're 850 years behind the curve. The Rambam basically had similar thoughts. He was a bottom line kind of guy. And that's why he condensed he bottom lined the Gemara in his Mishnah Torah. He says, "Yeah, Rebbe, you're just saying that, so I should go back to class and learn." So I said, no, I gave him some references. I said, go down to the Beis Medrash and bring me the following Rambam and Gemara. I showed him how the footnotes work. And then when he finished, I explained to him, I showed him how, an entire page of Gemara was condensed into a few lines of text in the Maimonides and Rambam. And then I said, I'd like to continue this discussion, go back to class. I don't want you to miss today's share, but come back and we'll talk. And I showed him, using a sports analogy, how the rule book, if you don't know why the rules were created, when you have a situation that you didn't anticipate, knowing and understanding how it was derived is essential to be able to think outside the box when you don't have an answer to everything. This kid happens to be very sports-oriented. But I'm very proud that the culture in our yeshiva is such that a Talmud is able to raise his hand and ask his Rebbe, why is this important? And not worry about getting a response, a negative response. One more thought on this. We actually find the Rambam Maimonides asks a question, what the Rav was saying, what Rabbi Korobkin was saying in Hilchos Deos. He asks the question that the whole idea of schar va'onesh, the whole idea of reward and punishment is predicated that we all have free choice. Right? If you don't have bechira chafshes, if you don't have free choice, how could God punish or reward you if you're constricted? So he asks the question, a very commonly asked question. We believe that God can see the future and we believe that we have free choice. How does that work? How could I really have free choice if God knows what I'm going to do? And to quote the vernacular, using sports term, the Rambam really punts. He really does not answer the question. He answers the question, but he says that lo machshavos machshavosechem, we cannot understand the quoting the Navi, that we don't understand everything there is to be about God. And he basically says that there are some things which we need to have faith in, even though it's something that we cannot. That's basically what he says. The Ravid, who was a commentary on the Rambam, uses extraordinarily harsh language to say basically, like, what was Rebbe thinking? Why did he ask a question if he didn't have an answer? He should have just left it out. And a few hundred years later, the Rambam didn't get a chance to respond. So the Kesef Mishnah, one of the commentaries says, well, of course Rebbe did it, because the Rambam did it, because he knew that any thinking person is going to have this question. So let people know that the Rambam struggled with this question as well. And it's a helpful thought. So I wrote a piece on this in Mishpacha magazine. It's called Rambam or Ravid. And I wrote that it's an educational philosophy that many schools and many educators in the Jewish world have the Ravid's approach. To use a military term, don't ask, don't tell. Okay? Don't ask, don't tell. Don't ask any questions. If the kid asks questions, just try to, just let it go. And don't, because other kids might have these questions. I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, with the internet and connectivity and Facebook and Twitter and everything, every question that's going to be raised, the kids are going to ask and be asked whether you know about it or not. So I wrote in the piece that I think we need to move to the Rambam's approach of an honest and open dialogue, but children can ask questions. Why would we not want them to ask questions when they're in our schools? Why would we not want them to ask us these questions they're going to struggle with when they're off in college or beyond or after they're married? So I think it's healthy to have these discussions. It's healthy to create a climate where children can ask these questions. And it's healthy, you might want to say, to have our fine young man here ask a question that Rabbi Korobkin and I can answer. I think it's important because you might want to know, what do I do if my kid asks me this question? Thank you.
Since we're talking about specific educational experiences, Ari, I'm wondering, you mentioned before that you didn't find the tradition sort of real or valid for you, that you were thinking subjectively. I'm interested in some of the experiences you had educationally that began to sort of turn your mind and specific difficulties that you felt you encountered, and also how people reacted when you raised those difficulties.
Well, it started off at first when I was in like middle school and elementary school. I asked a lot of questions, even ones I didn't really care about the answer to, just so like we could get off the topic in class. Most of the time, I didn't even care what the answer. I was the ADD kid. I didn't even listen to the answers. But but for the most part, really surprisingly, I got sufficient answers to my questions. And you might wonder why. So what am I doing here? It wasn't a lack of answers I was getting, a lack of good answers I was getting. My question started much later, but I'll get to that. While we're on the topic of answering questions and rabbis and whatnot, something...
rabbis.
And whatnot.
I'm the whatnot, he's the rabbi.
So, a specific experience in Jewish education that the doctor wanted me to elaborate on was something I find very interesting is that I don't think the problem is the kids are asking the questions that they're not getting the proper answers to. It's the kids that don't ask the questions that kind of just nod along and kind of get indoctrinated by everything the rabbis say. Like in a certain school I went to, a certain rabbi, he would get up there and he would say all these things that very controversial. He would say not such nice things about certain types of Judaism, certain like things about the Chabad and modern Orthodoxy and whatnot. And this was a very religious school, and most of the kids were rabbis' sons, and I was no daughters because it was guys' school, right? Or like at least my part of the school was a guys' school, right? So like. And he would get up there and he would say all these things and the kids they would just nod their head. And it was just like for me, I was in the back of the classroom and I was like so I would be so disturbed by it all. I would raise my hand and I would say like how do you say things like that? Maybe not as audacious as I say that right now, but I'd say like I think the Rebbe, Chabad Rebbe, he wasn't such a big fan of it. I'd say like, well, I think he was a pretty great guy. You know, like, what did he do that was so bad? Like, why can't we trust the kashrus of certain Chabad families? Like, he would say things like that. And I was the only one, I was really the only one who would even bring up the questions. And obviously, I wouldn't get the answers I was looking for. At least I would ask the questions. The rest of the kids were nodding, and they were just eating it. They were eating it all up. And they had absolutely no problem with it. But to get back to the part about answering the questions, a lot of the questions I had that really shaped where I am now, a lot of them didn't really have so much to do with the answers I was or wasn't getting, because there were more personal introspection questions. There weren't things that could necessarily be voiced to a rabbi or to an audience. There were things that were kind of more personal to me. And then the question I did have, I would look up. I felt very uncomfortable actually asking them to rabbis. Maybe that's something we could talk about. But it's just I didn't want to feel like I was sparking anything. Even though I was no stranger to controversy, I would bring up a lot of topics in class that weren't really the most acceptable things. It just made me feel uncomfortable starting to ask really deep questions about things like the existence of God and the validity of Judaism. I kind of shied away from actually asking them, at least out loud. So I looked at myself and I found my own answers. Maybe not the ones that you all would want me to find, but I found them.
I just want to clarify. So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that actually a bigger problem than somebody coming out publicly and asking a question and not being answered is actually the silence. In other words, statements are being made in the classroom. This is somewhat mirroring my wife's point that somebody says something, everybody sort of just accepts it unthinkingly, and the person who's actually considering it or thinking about it is shocked that nobody else seems to be, nothing going on in the room that would challenge this. And in some level, there's an atmosphere there that, in a way, it's not just the authority figures who are creating the atmosphere, but actually everybody's in collusion. The kids maybe unwittingly are also in collusion with this silence because they're not actually challenging anything that's going on. It's not actually the challenge, it's the lack of challenge that you're finding disturbing.
Right, well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess it depends what perspective you're coming from what you find more disturbing. Those kids are all perfectly happy on the derech right now. They weren't asking the question. They were the ones not asking the questions, not raising any hands or to any controversy or anything. But at the same time, they have all these ideas in their head about what the rabbi was saying. And I guess in many ways, it's against Judaism. He's saying Lashon Hara about, like I said, about Chabad and certain sects of Judaism. And yes, those kids are on the derech and they're davening 3 times a day, putting out the film, keeping kosher, and everything that a nice Orthodox Jewish boy is supposed to be doing. But I mean, they wouldn't. they wouldn't raise a hand when the rabbi was saying anything inappropriate. So I get, but me, on the other hand, I would talk to him. I would talk to him after class, talk to him during class. I would have like wars. It would be me versus the entire class and the rabbi, like yelling. And like it was pretty funny actually. But like, I guess so. It really depends. So who was the success stories, me or them? I asked the questions and I had trouble with the things that the rabbi was saying, and I raised my hand and look at me now. But they didn't, and look at them now. So you really, I mean, yes, it's kind of objective, or I'm sorry, subjective. Keep getting those mixed up. It's kind of subjective about which one you think is right and which one you think is wrong.
So picking up on that, and the kid who asks the question, or the kid who, quote unquote, is off the derrick, the analogy I would use in terms of a therapy model is the identified patient in a family. So you have, for instance, a kid who gets brought to therapy, supposedly they're the problem, but really they're the way in which the family, the system, is expressing a much more endemic systemic problem, right? And it happens to be the way it's showing up because they're the loudest or the most obvious, obviously symptomatic. I'm using this analogy because I really want to say something about the way the educational system in general is problematic, and that maybe the kids who are asking the questions and the kids who are voting with their feet are really trying to tell us something, and rather than pointing to it and saying, well, what's wrong with those kids, let's try to see what the common factor is with those kids, maybe they are the, so to speak, identified patient, not in the sense that they're sick, but they are the ones saying, dig here, because we have to understand systemically what's going on in the schools and in the way we teach religion, preach religion to our kids and to our community. So this gets into the topic that I was alluding to before, which is the gross imbalance between the head and the heart. In Jewish schools today, and it goes back as far as certainly when I was growing up, I was brought up religious, textual study, your intellect, that was everything. There was almost no what I would call God talk in the school. The only kids that I know who ever actually talked about a relationship with God was some Hasidic kids I was friends with, because I guess somebody said something about it at some point. But the only time God is spoken about or relationship with God is spoken about is either a biblical verse is being quoted or you're going to get punished for an aveira that you did. Kids are not raised. I can't say every and all. I imagine there are some teachers who are the exception, but kids are not raised, and it has nothing to do with which stripe of orthodoxy you happen to be part of. They're not raised with the feeling that, somewhat like in Christianity, God's my friend, that I'm in relationship. God sees all of me. God is not redundant, and therefore, if you're different than your friends, it's because you were meant to be that way, and that there's a dialogue that can be established from the time that you're little. None of that goes on in the schools. That's a problem. I think, personally, because there's been so much research in the world of neuroplasticity and neuropsychological research showing how much mindfulness, meditation, and all kinds of meditation, is helpful in integrating the left and right brains and just overall creating a sense of well-being and a sense of internal connectedness and then greater ability to give to others. I think from the time kids are in kindergarten, they should be taught on their level how to meditate, how to be still within. For the kids who are more hyperactive, so there's mindfulness, there's mindful movement. But kids need to have a feeling that they have a way of focusing inward, connecting to the deepest parts of themselves, which then can be connected to the God part of themselves, which would make kids like davening a lot better, because my guess is that 2/3, if not more, of the kids in the class can't stand davening, I mean, based on what I hear. They sort of grow up and they learn to mumble better or worse, but they're not really connecting to anything, and there's a hole, and there's a real imbalance. I mean, just to tell you that from a research point of view, when mindfulness meditation is practiced on a regular basis, there is a difference in the fMRIs of the people, their brains. People are more balanced in general in terms of behavior. They're more fluid, they're more flexible, they don't feel the need to defend and compensate with either rigid behavior or chaotic and fragmented behavior, which are the two extremes. People are just generally healthier, which would translate into healthier religious behavior, right? Wouldn't be a need to overemphasize the external to the detriment of the internal. All of these things could be changed if this kind of focus in the schools. I have more to say, but I'll let...
Well, we'll come back. I wanted to go back to something that Rabbi Kropotkin said a minute ago in terms of this Beis Yaakov girl, and I thoroughly agreed with the point you made, which is that often, I mean, I've spent part of my life watching teachers teach because that's part of what I do, training teachers. And one of the things that's become a rule for me is that when a teacher denigrates a question, it's most often the fact that they have no idea how to answer the question. Teachers basically teach to the level of what they know. That's a rule of thumb. You can only get from them what they've gotten from somebody before them. And that's very frustrating for the students. So my question is, this really entails a much larger macro question that I think is in some ways the heart of the matter, which is how should our teachers be trained? In other words, before they're even entering the classroom, what is it in terms of pedagogical criteria? What should they be expected to know? I've been at schools where people have been sort of hired kind of in a momentary notice. There's no actual systematic program for why are you teaching in this school? What is it that you know? Just because you learned for several years doesn't necessarily mean that you have the pedagogical skills involved. So basically, I'm asking you, what do you think the teacher should know, and how should they be trained before they enter our classrooms?
Very good question. I'm going to answer your question in somewhat of a circuitous nature by first addressing Ari. And just to tell you my personal story, the year that I almost left Yiddishkeit completely, and I remember it very clearly, it was my 11th grade year in high school. And I had switched schools from one school to another for unimportant reasons for now. And the two rebbeim that I had in this new school, which is now a very respected established school, were inexperienced. And I was a handful. And I asked a lot of questions. And I didn't always toe the line. I used to come late to davening. And these were all ways of my acting out that... I wanted to test these guys and give them a run for their money and see if they had what it took to be a real Rebbe. And I got in trouble with both of them. And at one point, one of the Rebbes, in a fit of frustration, I came into the class late, as I many times often did, and he was in the middle of telling the boys how the way that you come to davening and if the time that you come to davening and the way that you daven is an expression of your closeness to Hashem. And I just saw red. I said, are you telling me that if I come late to davening, I'm not as close to Hashem as you are? And he said, absolutely, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I just stormed out. And I had it. And I was ready to leave Yiddishkeit. There were, I think, three factors that prevented me from leaving. One is I knew it would kill my mother, who really sacrificed a lot to give us an Orthodox upbringing. My dad would have accepted it because my dad himself became Orthodox because of my mom, but my mom comes from a very hush of a family that were killed in the war, and I had like this guilt looming over me that I had a responsibility to perpetuate my namesake who was killed by Hitler, who was a rabbi. Number two, it was that I had a good Rebbe the year before who I loved and who showed me love and who showed me concern and care and was willing to entertain my mishigas. And the third factor was in the very next year, I knew I was going to Israel. So whatever was going to happen, this crazy school that I was in that totally turned me off to Yiddishkeit, I knew that perhaps there was something waiting for me at the next horizon. So Now I'm going to answer the question, but I wanted to reflect upon that because it seems to me, Ari, that at least part of the thing that brought you on this journey to where you are today is that you lost respect for that figure of authority in Judaism because he doesn't represent all of the greatness that Judaism advertises or professes to have. If we are the chosen people, and we are elevated, and we are lofty, and the Torah is this greatest gift to mankind that is supposed to bring us to a sense of primacy as human beings, then how can this man who calls himself a rabbi say such disparaging and nasty things in public and still hold his head high as a rabbi and say that's Judaism and that's Torah? And I relate to that. I'm not saying that your the decisions in life that brought you to this, I can't say that I would want to see you continue in this path, but I understand that if that was one of the contributing factors, I get it. Now, what do we have to do to train our teachers? Well, Dr. Elliot Malamud, I mean, you hit upon it. Our schools are groaning under the weight of financial straits. And for us to hire pedagogical experts with multiple PhDs in philosophy and education, and having gone to seminary, and having gone to yeshiva, number one, they don't exist. And if they did exist, they would cost us more than our annual budget, each one of them. So that's the dilemma. So I would say that there's one thing that every teacher needs to be taught if they're going to get into the classroom. And the one thing they need to be taught is saying, I don't know, to an answer will not lose points. It'll get you points with your students. Is that what you were going to say? Every time that our teachers have told us, I don't know, it's a good question, I want to look into it, or I think you should speak to so-and-so who probably has a good answer, has a good way of explaining it, the children respect us as educators.
It's funny, guy. I just had prepared this. I did a training session this past Thursday night. Shaul Anisfeld and some others have a really nice mentoring program down south. and they, since I was in town, they asked me to speak to the guys. One of the questions that came up says, what happens if a kid asks me? One of them was, I tried to create the environment that they could ask whatever they wanted. And one of them said, what happens if a kid asks me questions that I don't know? He didn't say that I don't know the answer to, that I'm not comfortable in, whatever he said. That's what he meant. So I said, what better way is there to model great behavior than by saying, that's an excellent question. Let's go together and find somebody in town who gets it and can answer a question that you don't have the answer to. I said, how validating is it for a child? And I'm not saying you should do it in a phony way because that's what the kid needs to hear. Do it genuinely so. Say, really, that's a great question. I don't know the answer. Let's go together to someone who may have that answer. I think it's an issue of self-confidence also. The best teacher, think of the best teacher you ever had. They all projected a certain aura that you're not going to rattle them, and whatever you're going to say, whatever a child's going to ask, you say, okay, or even the kid disturbs, you say, okay, Yitzi, we need to talk about that after class. Anyway, as I was saying, they don't get rattled. I think it's a question of self-confidence. I wouldn't say what Rabbi Karupkin said about what we need to do to train our staff and that it's difficult to find people like that. It's okay if they don't know. It's not okay if they don't know and they say things that aren't right and say things that are disparaging and say things that really diminish the entire religious experience. I'm just going to close this thought with I started Project S 17 years ago, and we've been dealing with a lot of these issues for a very long time. Our posek was and is for the past 17 years, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky Shlita. And I've had the great schus, the great merit of being able to get close with him and listen to his opinion. He really gets it. So many, many years ago, I asked him, a kid came, someone called us, called the office, and he left me a message. I called him back. He said, my son came home. My son is an Aleph Plus student. You know, the best bachur in Lakewood. You know, he was really a great kid. He was a junior, a senior in high school. He was 17, because from the answer. So he came home. He says, you know, Ta, I learned great. I'm a masmid, a great. I don't believe one word they're telling me there. What should I say? The father, he asked this of the father. The father called me up. I said, this is above my pay grade. I'll get right back to you. So I said, you know, I had a few answers that I had thought of that I wanted to share with him. I called up Shmuel Kamenetsky. I said, Rebbe, what would you advise a father to say if a child says something like this? And his answer just blew me away. He said, David HaMelech says, Yemesh Naseinu Behem Shivim Shana, that our sojourn on this world is 70 years, you know, metaphorically. We have a limited time on this earth. And during this time, we're supposed to elevate ourselves and try to understand God and His world and the Torah that He gave us. So he says, tell the father that he should tell the kid, you're 17 years old, you got 53 years to go. So rather than saying, you're an apikoros, and rather than saying, I can't believe you don't believe everything, say, okay, continue in your exploration and search for the truth. And I thought it was such a brilliant answer. It was such a brilliant answer. That's it.
I'm going to take a little bit of issue with you.
Yeah.
We surely can do better than the picture of saying, the way you set it up was, well, we don't have a budget for PhDs in philosophy, and so therefore we can't go that way. So we'll use the more sort of modest approach of saying, I don't know when I don't know. Now, I certainly would not quarrel with saying, I don't know when I don't know. But from my point of view, the problem here is that you should know. And there are actually ways to know. And the ways to know would mean that if you're going back into your yeshiva education, that education has to become far more variegated and sophisticated if you're going to go into education. It's one thing to simply be learning your whole life, but if you're going to be exposed to children, and you know that, then before you go to those children, I think there should be a track of some kind that teaches you in yeshiva. And it's also talking about a much larger issue about what are you exposed to, what do you allow yourself to read, what do you know about actual educational theory. And the thing of it is, it does not require a doctorate in any way to do this. So I think that I don't know is good, but actually there's a lot we can be doing that won't strain the budgets of schools. And this is a much larger topic, but I do think we can do much better.
I agree, but surely, Dr. Elliot Malamud, you understand the historical evolutions that our yeshiva system and our seminary systems have undergone since the 19th century and even earlier. There has been a conscious decision over the centuries to squelch philosophical inquiry within our yeshiva systems. This was a decision that was consciously made over the course of several centuries. It was somewhat, perhaps even a reaction to the Maimonidean conflicts that arose in the Middle Ages, where there was a perception that Jews who were inquiring and delving into philosophical or theological issues were going off the derech in the equivalent to what was happening in the Middle Ages. And the yeshivas have consigned themselves today, and therefore this is not even such a comment on the educators, on the pedagogy, but the educational philosophy of our yeshiva system. There's been a conscious decision to be completely skill-based. We teach our first graders Aleph Beis and Parshas Bereishis. We teach them Dinim. We teach them Gemara. We teach them Mishnah as they become more advanced. And we teach the girls Chumash and Rashi, Ramban, Nach, a little bit of Machshevet Yisrael. But not, so it's the skills that they need to have. And we assume, because that's not our job, that they're going to get the bigger picture somewhere else. The problem is that they we're always passing the football to someone else to give our kids the bigger picture. We as parents don't view that as our role. The schools don't view it as their role. And so our children are left trying to figure it out on Google. And if your child's going to try and figure out the bigger picture and the purpose and meaning of life on Google, then I can guarantee you that if you Google the meaning of life, you're probably going to get something from
Monty Python.
Right, well, Monty Python, that'll be one, right? But you'll definitely get
a song by George Harrison. I didn't know that, somebody told me.
Or you'll get something from Hitchens, an essay from Hitchens, guaranteed, or something from a Catholic or Christian theologian before you get something on Yiddishkeit. And that's really what it's all about. I mean, you heard from Ari. He said he was looking for answers. He wasn't getting them from his teacher. He wasn't satisfied. So he did his own research. I'd venture to guess that you went on Google to get some of those answers, Ari, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. But the answers, the information age provides us with information without filters. And so unless there's going to be a commitment in our school system, in our yeshiva system, to carve out some space to give our children the big picture, a curriculum that's designed to give our children, call it the big picture, call it the meaning of life, whatever you're going to call it, and why we believe what we believe, then this is only going to continue and get worse.
Right. So I don't disagree with anything that was said. I just I think that the everything is on top of another layer, which is on top of another layer, which is to say that, yes, it's correct that saying I don't know is important. It's also correct to say that's not good enough, because the teachers should be prepared and should know. But we're not talking about the fact that the reason why, in addition to the kind of a philosophical decision that was made in terms of the educational system many years ago, one of the reasons why it is perpetuated now in the system, where the teachers themselves are not prepared to have the conversations to answer the questions, because they themselves have been raised on a certain system. But that begs the question of why has the system been perpetuated? It's not just because it is a philosophical decision made. It's because, and this is the kind of thing everybody knows about but doesn't speak about very much, is that there is a fear in the Orthodox community, a very deep fear across the spectrum. Everybody, no matter where they're standing, is looking over their right shoulder. Everyone is worried about the way they will seem, if they will be perceived as from enough, saying the right things, doing the right things, and so on. I'm not bashing the idea of being observant or of learning Torah. What I'm saying is that it's not an accident that the teachers are not being trained this way. The teachers are being raised within a culture of fear, where people are far more worried about the gaze of other people than about God's gaze. Everybody lives it within the Orthodox community. Doesn't matter where on the spectrum they are. It just depends, you know, depending on where you are, who you consider more to the right of you. And if you live in that kind of a culture, you're not going to train teachers to be able to read the things they're supposed to read, to be able to answer the questions, to be able to not just wait for the questions to come to you, to proactively raise questions so that kids have them raised in the context of their schools and don't have to look elsewhere. They're not going to say, why should we listen to Chazal and get everybody talking about it? They're not going to raise issues of tzniut in terms of body image and so on. I don't say it never happens, but it's the exception, not the rule. So we really have to talk about a much deeper illness within the Orthodox community, which the teachers are only a symptom of this problem, and the kids who are defecting are only a symptom of that symptom. There's an overall imbalance in terms of the way Orthodoxy is given over, and a fear between people.
Just that, you know, it's interesting, Doctor. I was listening to you now, and you're making excellent points. I just want to throw out two things. One is that there is an incredible, substantive difference the way our children learn from grades 1 through 12 and when they go off to seminary or the year in Israel. And having raised 4 married kids, Kaneinahara, the girls go off to seminary, and all of a sudden, the teachers come in and say, you can ask anything you want. And the experience is such that, so my point is, we do have a model that's effective. The kids go off to, many of the kids go off to many of the seminaries and many of the yeshivot in Eretz Yisrael, and all of a sudden they're able to ask whatever they want. There's a project Inspire that runs weekends where Jewish adults whose parents have spent a lot of money on tuition all the years, the adults are now in their 20s and 30s and 40s, are going to get inspiration and to get these same questions that they want to find out, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? So there clearly is an identifiable gap, but I propose to you that in some ways we are addressing it. I think we need to do it an awful lot earlier.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
I repeat what I said before, which is that in any of these projects, including Inspire, people teach to the level of what they've been exposed to.
Agreed.
So we'll leave it at that. I wanted to...
Say that I've had too many conversations with too many parents who have said to me, I really know what the educational environment or a certain decision that should be made for my child would be given this child's personality, academic abilities, and so on. But I'm afraid to take them out of X school and put them into a different system because I'm concerned that it will set something into motion that is unretrievable. What does that mean? We're talking about 6-year-olds. 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds. This is not one conversation. This is not 5 conversations where they are looking at the child and they say, ideally, in a perfect world, this is where the kid should be. I understand that. But I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, her 18-year-old sister is out on the shidduch market now. They'll find out that the 6-year-old is going to Crestwood, whatever. Okay, pick a school, right? This kid is now going to be in Associated as opposed to, you know, Yesode or Eitz Chaim or whatever, right? So somebody later, when this kid is up for a Shiduchim, will look back and say, what was their educational history? She said, you set them off on a trajectory that is going to determine the rest of their lives because then they won't get into other yeshivas when they get older, and then those yeshivas, the feeder schools for the other yeshiva, and by the time you're done, the catastrophic images and how the whole life gets set up based on what other people are going to say in the future, right, as opposed to who is this child, what does this child need, right? This is, I don't blame these parents. They're part of a much larger system. We're all part of a much larger system, which has to be corrected. Because everybody is suffering from it in some way or another, whether they realize it or not. And there are comments made on the playground between children also that we don't know about, right? Because they don't tell you everything that happens at home. I hear about it in a therapy office, the things that kids have had to suffer. Comments either made about themselves or about their siblings or about their parents. So,
I think we all acknowledge intellectually that we just have to all get over it. You're never going to be from enough for someone else in this room.
Right.
You're never going to be from enough. I'm never going to be from enough, and so I've sort of given up on that.
I want you to know that you're from enough for me.
Thank you.
Doctor, you know, the line I've been telling parents for over 10 years now is that we mentioned about changing schools. The line I've been telling parents for over 10 years now is if you're embarrassed about little things, parentheses, and make poor placement decisions because of it, close parentheses, you're going to wind up getting embarrassed an awful lot more for a lot more substantive things. And I think I said about self-confidence of teachers, I think parents need to have self-confidence to do what their children need. And honestly, just ignore all the chatter. because ultimately it's your children and you're going to have to deal with it. If you're embarrassed about little things and you make decisions that are good for others but not good for your children, you're not going to get for your kids and you're not going to get for the others. That's the line. If you're embarrassed about little things, you're going to get more embarrassed about big things. Just do what's right for your children and have the courage to turn your back to the crowd and do what you know in your heart is correct.
We're going to go a little further and then, you know, open it up to the floor. I did want to ask about the family dynamics once a child begins to rebel from observance, and ask all of you, I'm actually going to begin by asking Ari to talk about his thoughts on the matter. How should parents react when children begin to sort of reject Torah practices? I'm especially interested in a certain dilemma that I think families face, which is that on the one hand, we want to unconditionally love and accept our children. So should kids be unconditionally accepted no matter what they do in terms of religious rejection or rebellion? Or should there be consequences or even disciplines for failure to comply with the parents' religious expectations? I think that's a very hard problem for parents. They're trying to figure out, should I be, you know, sort of tolerant? How tolerant should I be? And if they do take a softer approach, what do they do if the child begins to influence other children within the family context? So I'm wondering sort of how it was for you and what you think about, you know, how families should think about this.
Well, I don't really have a PhD in child psychology or a smicha or anything, so I'm not sure how.
I'll give you a smicha.
But am I religious enough for you?
Rabbi Korupkin is.
So I'm not sure how, from like a scientific or rabbinical perspective, definitely not the last one, I can answer the question, but I can tell you what you shouldn't do or what shouldn't happen. I would say don't give a child anything to hate. And this goes for Judaism, goes for leaving Judaism, goes for pretty much everything. And any sort of value you're trying to instill upon your child, I would say just don't, whatever you do, just don't have them hate it. Like, if they could even like it a little bit, there's a lot less of a chance that they're going to leave it. And then once they do leave it, there's a lot less of a chance they're going to come back to it. A lot less of a chance to come back to it than if they have something to despise. So, and then what's already gone, you have, I guess, for me it was a little bit different. I never really had, I mean, me and my parents get along pretty well. So, I think, I was never really, there was not much rebelling. It was kind of like, I actually sent them an email. It was that, like, actually planned out. That's how I did it. I told them I don't really believe in this stuff anymore. Then reply, if you want. We sat down, we had a meeting about it. Like, that's how I do things. I'm maybe a little bit too calculating and obsessive compulsive, but whatever. So for me it's a little bit different, but in general, I think a lot of kids who reject Judaism, it's because they have something that they just really dislike about it. And then that thing becomes even more massive once they actually do leave it. And that's really the reason why they don't come back. And if you have your parents, if you decide to stop davening and you decide you don't believe in God or whatever, and you have your parents yelling at you, screaming, you have to daven, and you think, well, this is what really God really wants. He really wants us arguing like this. He wants you yelling and taking away all these things from me just so I could daven. And then, well, almost certainly, I think we can all agree that the kid's not going to come back after that, because A, he doesn't get along with his parents anymore. B, he doesn't like davening. He's being forced to daven. And there's probably a C or a third thing or whatever, but I can't really remember it. Thank you for the one person who laughed at that. I appreciate it. So really, that's it. Don't give them anything to hate. Don't give them anything to resent. And then I think it's much less likely that they will leave. And this, it just really goes for everything. But once they do leave, if they have nothing, if there's no qualms about it, then they'll come back. They may or may not come back. But if there's something that really they really resent about it, really leaves a bad taste in their mouth, there's no way anyone's coming back.
I think it's rare for a week to go by where I don't get the question from a family in our shul as to how to interact and work with a child that is not from, that is not observant in their home. It is that common, and I'm not exaggerating. there are a lot of different unique situations, so it's impossible to answer this as a one-size-fits-all question, but I thank Ari for that thing. Never give your child something to hate is one guideline. But here's the other thing. You have to differentiate between whether the child is living at home or whether they're not living at home, whether they're older and they're living out of the house. It's much easier to have a healthy relationship with a child who's not observant, that's not under your roof, than it is if they're still living at home with you. If they're not living under your roof, so the advice that I give is that, how would you do kiruv if that was not your child? You know, we have piskei halacha that tell us that you can invite someone to Shabbos even if you know they're going to drive, either as long as they're within walking distance of your home, or if you give them the opportunity to sleep over your house. So you should do the same kiruv with your own child. If your child lives downtown somewhere in Spadina or Bloor, and they're not from, and they're living a bohemian, whatever, however they're living their life, right? Invite them for Shabbos dinner. Have them over your home. And just as someone who is not from may do things that you'll just ask them, would you mind just not texting or answering the phone at the Shabbos table? Then you say, this is what we expect of you, our son or our daughter as well. And if the child is living under your roof, then make sure that you don't confuse parental responsibility and rules of the house with religion. The two things sometimes get obscured. If you were not religious and you had a child that was sleeping until 2 in the afternoon and partying until 5 in the morning, then that's not a religious issue. That's an issue that the kid's becoming a bum. And you lay down the law and you say, we're either kicking you out of your house or you're going to do certain things. It's got nothing to do with Judaism. I expect you, if you're going to live under my roof, we have certain rules in the house that you have to live by. I expect you up by a certain time. You need to get a job or you need to do certain chores. And Shabbos becomes a real issue because the child doesn't want to come to the Shabbos table. So fine. Or he doesn't want to go to shul. You don't want to go to shul? No problem. You're going to set up the Shabbos meal for the rest of us because that's one of the chores in the house. In other words, what I'm trying to say is don't confuse religion for being a good parent. Don't abdicate your parenting skills just because your child is not orthodox. Make sure that you're a responsible parent and you'll work through the issues of orthodoxy on a case-by-case basis.
So I'll just give a little bit of just general psychological insight into the way things work. If you're not aware of your own emotional issues, there's a tendency when people are not in touch with the things that they don't want to deal with, to translate that into being very hysterical and reactive when their kids are doing certain things, because really the kids' behavior is triggering something in them that they're not aware of. So how does that work? There'll be all kinds of catastrophic reactions, whether the kid is not yet not religious, but just kind of breaking some rules, or the kid has decided not to be from. It can be, let's take the case of a child who, you know, just doesn't feel like davening or did something on Shabbos they weren't supposed to be doing, and the reaction can be very, very disproportionate to what actually occurred. There's like screaming and yelling and how could you, and sort of over the top. And one thing that's important to keep in mind is, generally speaking, the things that we fear, if we overreact to them, we actually unwittingly often create self-fulfilling prophecies, that we create the very things that we fear with these kinds of reactions. So two of the questions that I ask, that I suggest to people to think about so they can have more moderated reactions to their kids and be able to not box the kid in a way that makes them feel like there's no way to be in this place but out, or there's no room to discuss whatever I'm frustrated about, is to say, okay, if this wasn't your kid, it's similar to this, if this was somebody who was, you're being makar of them, but if this wasn't your kid, how would you advise the person, it was your friend's kid, how would you advise them to respond to this infraction? And they usually get a lot more sane, a lot more rational, a lot calmer, a lot more moderate. And the reason is because the equation of what this child does represents me. represents who I am, what I have done in my life, in the community, et cetera, is taken away. And they can think about it in kind of more measured terms. Okay, who is this kid? What did this behavior represent? What maybe is trying to communicate? What kind of conversation do we need to have to understand it better? So that's the first question is, it's your friend. What would you advise? Take you out of it. Stop making it about you. See the child. See this child as an individual. What is their behavior communicating? What are they trying to tell you? The second question, which is it's easier to ask than to answer, but it's a crucial question, is if I wasn't so busy worrying about this kid doing X or Y or not doing X or Y, what other feelings, what other thoughts would I become aware of? Because often we distract ourselves by getting super upset, super mad, super worried, super guilty about all kinds of things about our children as a way of avoiding the stuff that we don't want to look at in ourselves. So there's like a hyper reaction to the child, because the child is triggering something in you at that moment, and that's why you're having the hyper reaction. So if you could slow down the tape and say, if I wasn't so busy, meaning emotionally busy, focusing on worrying, feeling guilty, getting angry, what else would I become aware of? Well, I might become aware of stuff that I never dealt with, stuff I feel guilty about, stuff I'm trying to compensate for through my kids, that my kids are maybe acting out unconsciously. You get a lot of information. For everybody, the answer is different, but it's important to realize that there's a lot going on when you're reacting to your kid's religious behavior, and it's not all about the kid.
A very common question that parents, and many, we all basically alluded to it in one way or another, what do you tell the other kids? What effect is it going to have if we say, like, it's kind of okay to live at home if you're not keeping Shabbos, let's say? We at Project Yes, for over 15 years, we've been advising parents not to send children away from home. We have not found it to be contagious. And if it is, it's often, sometimes it's the issues that, but the first one might cause another one, but it's not that it's contagious. It's not that the children, one child is going to affect the other children. If there is active undermining, which is pretty rare, that a child is actively looking to undermine the parent's authority and the religion in the house, it's a different story. But typically, we have not found it to be contagious. But I'd like to bring another perspective to it. I think it's a terrible message for the other children when you send the kid out. Because what you're really saying is that my love for you is conditional on your observance. And should your observance diminish, then our affection for you is going to be diminished. So even if they are observant, how could they possibly have that same love and affection for their family when they know it's conditional on something? So I think, you know, I often tell parents to develop a third category. You know, there's one category, this is okay with us, this is not okay with us. The third category is, it's not okay, but you're our child, so we're going to deal with it and we love you. So I really think I think it undermines the family unit when a child is asked to leave home because of a matter of religion.
So I did want to throw it open to the floor. I just want to have a sense, if you could raise your hand, if people have so there are enough people to ask questions. Okay, so what we're going to do then is you need to come down to the front and use the microphone. And if you are going to do that, so you should sort of line up. And so I'm going to ask you two things, please. One is, that you ask a question, not give a speech. And secondly, if you have a thought in mind to whom you want the question directed, so please direct it to them. Before we take questions, though, could we please give our speakers a warm hand? So please say whom you want to direct it to, if or anyone, and make it a question, and try and make it brief. Could I have quiet, please? Thank you.
I have two questions for Ari. The first question is, Yiddishkeit wasn't for you. Did you find what was for you? And the second question is, what did you think of the suggestion that the big question, the big issues, are not raised by traditional schools? I find that they are raised, for example, in Kiruv organizations, these big picture questions. They weren't asked in your schools. They aren't asked in ordinary schools. What did you think of the suggestion that they be raised in traditional schools? So the first question is, did you find something that was for you? The second question is, what do you think about raising big issue questions?
Right, so did I find something that is for me? I think the beauty of the situation is that I haven't, and I don't think I really have to. And it sounds kind of ridiculous when you think about it. With Judaism, there's very narrow confines of what needs to be done and what can and can't be done. And that's wonderful in some ways, but in other ways, it's very restricting. And I found not that, I'll talk tomorrow about why I eventually decided it wasn't for me. It was through nothing to do with the restrictions or anything to do with that. I just decided, well, we'll stay tuned, I guess, for that. But I haven't found what's for me, and I have an open eye, and I'm looking. But the bottom line is that there doesn't have to be anything for me. I could just live. There's plenty of time for searching.
53 years.
So I have 52 more years. But that doesn't have to be an answer, I don't think. I think that's really the beauty of it. And the second part of the question was, what?
do you feel that there are other organizations that maybe raise larger questions that would be of interest to you? Although I don't suspect that that's the problem for you.
Right. So it's interesting. I don't know about that specifically, but just something you may find interesting is that I went to a very religious Orthodox camp. There definitely wasn't a more religious, but it was all boys. So and everyone wore a yarmulke and tzitzit, so it was pretty religious. And I asked my mom if I could switch to Camp Nagila, which I had a couple of friends go to, which is a Kiruv camp. And she said, why would you want to do that? I said, well, I feel like they'll be nicer to us if they're trying to get us to become religious. So there's that.
Well done.
Mark Zaffer. The first part of the discussion was about two kinds of kids, the ones who are drifting along, sleepwalking, and accepting everything. The other is the ones who are asking questions. There's a third kind of kid that I think is very important, and we haven't addressed that, and I think is a problem not just for us, but for the religious world in general, the Catholic world especially, and that's the kid that doesn't care. That when you engage with those kids, their answer is, I just don't care. I'm not interested. I don't care.
So what's the question?
What do we do with them?
What do we do with those kids? Okay. Mm-hmm. So what do we do with kids who are completely apathetic to anybody?
I can only tell you that I don't actually believe that people don't care. I think that's another way of saying, ask me a different question. I'll tell you what I mean. I interviewed people about their relationship with God, and there was two interviews, relationship with God and relationship with parents, and there was a comparison. So you think it's a showstopper if the opening question for relationship with God, you ask somebody, tell me about your relationship with God or spirituality from the time that you're very young till the present as an opening. And they say, I don't believe in God. So you think, okay, the interview is over, right? So I nonplussed. I said, okay, tell me about the God you don't believe in. And they talked for 2 hours. So I don't actually think I don't care. It's like saying I'm confused, I'm bored. There's another question to be asked. There's another way in. There's something else going on. It's just not been my experience that it stays there. And if there is a feeling of I don't care, it's because somebody has not spoken about religion, and this is what we were speaking about before, in a way that in any way feels like it is relevant to the kid's life.
Okay, no, we have a long line behind you, so we're going to have to go. Yep.
I have a question for Rabbi Horowitz, based on your experience and number of years and with children. It was a very interesting panel and getting diverse kind of opinions and views, but I found it quite one-dimensional. I'm wondering, in your history with young children, what about the family makeup? What kind of effect does that have on children growing up to, you know, keeping Judaism or not? Rabbi Krapkin touched on a few issues, sort of like parental expectation, parental connection, and perhaps even a Holocaust type of background. What about intact families and families where parents do not live together with the children?
So
wouldn't
asking,
you say that would have at least as much of an impact as the educational system?
There was a very interesting doctoral thesis done by a young lady in Har Nof, Israel. She shared it with me. It was probably about 12, 15 years ago. And what she had subjects, you know, she had seminary girls all around her. So she did her thesis comparing the children's experience about Shabbos to their commitment to religion and raising the children the way they were, their children the way they raised. And she asked them to identify four times. She sent me the questionnaire. It had four times. Thursday night, what's life in your house like? Thursday night, Friday afternoon, Friday night, you know, like, what's it like? Some of the girls wrote the most beautiful things. I come home Thursday night and it's just, we unwind and we have time together and the house smells like Shabbat and everybody's relaxed and it's so beautiful. And she got some notes about, like, the heart-wrenching about the tension and the yelling and, you know, the stress level that everybody's in and expectations about the Shabbat table and who's going to say it's about Torah and if you'll do this and that. And she found a stunning correlation between the Shabbat experience at home and their commitment to observance. So I think there is a often, not always, but often the culture at home and the quality of the home life at home, whether it's a, you know, two-parent household, a single-parent household, it's about the level of simchat hachayim at home. Is there positive energy in the house? Is it the type of home the kids want to hang out in? We have found that to be a predictor, not always, of course, but it certainly is not a predictor. It's a factor in the children's level of observance.
Next.
My question is for Ari. So first, I just wanted to say, I thought it's very brave of you that you changed your whole path, and I feel like that's probably something all tshuvas go through, where you probably took a lot of slack, and also the fact that you said your beliefs here, I think, was also really brave. But my question is, I've noticed that in the panel, nobody said that maybe you did what you did because you believe that's true and it's not because of some psychological phenomenon or schools or whatever. Is this common to you to happen a lot, that people assume it's a emotional thing versus an intellectual thing? And do you feel that it's more intellectual?
Right. So I truly think it's intellectual. I think there's absolutely no subjectivity to it. You wrote it down for me. There's no subjectivity. Everything, like I said, I really thought it out. It wasn't an.
So you didn't use just the dreaded Google. You also had discussions.
Yeah. No.
With Google.
I mean, I asked rabbis. It was science. It was intellect, whatnot, etc. But I really do think that there is a misconception about it, that I think everyone says it's there has to be something wrong, there has to be an emotional problem, a psychological problem, problem with the home. Yeah, that is something I encounter a lot. I mean, people who aren't religious have no problem thinking that you're just doing it from an intellectual perspective, but very common among religious people, almost exclusively, they assume that there has to be some sort of issue.
How does that make you feel? I know I'm not supposed to.
I'm okay with that.
You're okay with everyone?
Yeah, I have to say something because I feel that I've been called into question also.
My apologies.
No, that's okay, but implicit in your question was that I was making assumptions about Ari, which I wasn't.
Right.
And I don't think anyone should. I completely acknowledge that there could be any number of reasons why people who grew up in Orthodox homes choose to leave. Some of them are intellectual, some of them are emotional, some of them are psychological, some of them because they had a negative experience with a figure of authority who represented themselves as religious. There could be any number of reasons. And so I don't think we're disagreeing on that.
Next.
All right, rest my case. Thank you.
I just want to caveat the comments about that it's okay for a teacher to say, I don't know. I don't want my kids' math teacher saying that. So this is a question for the moderator. Do you really believe if a child has a question where he doesn't believe in God or doesn't want to keep Shabbat or feels like he's gay, that you want to focus on how the schools as opposed to the parents should address that? And then related to that, if you could give advice as parents, how can we get more tools or be better at communicating with our kids?
I'm not sure that I'm clear on the question. I mean, in other words, a child's not going to come into school and necessarily talk about his homosexuality. What he might do, and I've received hundreds of such questions, are what does Judaism think about being gay? Or what does Judaism think about any sort of set topic? My point earlier was that the teacher will know how to handle that question, or at least even begin to approach that question based on the amount that they've actually inputted prior. So if you have a narrow view of what Judaism says about a whole number of topics, then you will convey exactly what it is that you know. But I've seen, because I've seen it in action, that teachers who have had a wide amount of exposure in a sophisticated level to be able to answer theological, sociological, political, sexual questions about Judaism will empower the child by giving them the range of possibilities. And as was alluded to earlier, they'll join the conversation of Jewish history. They won't feel quite as ostracized because they'll recognize that, A, the question itself is not treif. There's nothing treif about a question. Rav Soloveitchik used to say, nobody dies from a question. And second of all, that not only is the question not treif, but actually it's been thought about in often an agonizing fashion prior, and that in many ways we are imposing limits on these questions simply because of our own ignorance, and that comes to training. So it's not even a question of persuasion. I don't answer questions in class because I necessarily want to persuade the child. You've asked me a question. It's my job to give you as honest and as wide and as lateral a set of answers, not one answer, to your question. If you want to follow up with me afterwards and dialogue with me, I can. Right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to, on one foot, just to reiterate what I said before about parents getting themselves out of the way. I think a lot of the problem that parents have answering a question, honestly, is because as soon as the child is asking a question or making a statement, all kinds of things that we're maybe not so conscious of come rush to the fore to protect. What does this mean about my kid? What does this mean about me? What does it mean about, you know, they can't hear the question anymore. So if we can get ourselves out of the way, it's not about what are all the implications of X, Y, and Z. This, what is the kid asking me? Right? What is the question? Let me ask more questions to understand the context in which they came to ask this question. Treat it in a way, again, as if it isn't your child on a certain level asking the question. You have to get your personal feeling of being threatened out of the way, and then you can hear what the actual question is and answer it on its terms. Give it, you know, and ask better questions to understand the context and the nuances of it. So that's like A. Also, I would say parenthetically, like, believe a little bit in the power of the religion and the Torah. It's almost like people don't really trust, ironically, on some level, that the Torah will out, that the relationship with God will out. So there's such care to finesse and answer in a way that won't, where there won't be holes, it'll be okay. You can answer more openly. You can answer in a more nuanced fashion. You can answer that there are different views. It's more powerful than you're treating it. You're treating it as if it's fragile, and it's not that fragile. Okay, that's a comment. The other thing, again, it's a repeat, but I can't emphasize it enough. If people imagine that they're not going to answer a question, or they're going to avoid something, or they're going to kind of do a surface, that it's going to go away. It's not going to go away. It's just going to go underground. It's going to resurface in a different fashion. It's going to show up behaviorally. It's going to show up emotionally, relationally. In some way, it's going to show up. The best thing you can do for your kids and for yourselves, all of us, is to let ourselves be aware of all the parts that make us up, right? The parts that we don't like, the parts we do like, the impulses that we're not proud of. Not to banish them, because when they get banished, then you have no control. The paradox is, actually, that when you banish them, you have less control. And when you allow consciousness to it, you have more control. Right? And you could not to say that you therefore, now that you know about all the pieces, you express them all, without any discipline, without any self-regulation. That's your job as a parent, too. Now that we know what the pieces are, we can kind of help the kid to figure out how much and when and whatever. But you can't deal with what's below the surface. You can't deal with what you don't know about. That's how it works. So just the comment that the Sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe said about Kibbutz Galiot, I mean, he was, obviously it meant, you know, the ingathering of the exiles in a literal sense, but he was talking about the psychological aspect. He was talking about in relation to Teshuvah. That Kibbutz Galiot means you have to be able to take and ingather all the exiled parts of yourself. You have to know. You can't take them in if you don't know about them. And you can't make a child feel that they can be brought in if you're already threatened.
Next. So the evening started out with a film about the rabbi's daughters, not the rabbi's sons. And I'm kind of wondering, we've kind of had this entire discussion about children without reference to the fact that men and women, boys and girls, are actually educated quite differently and occupy quite different roles within the Jewish community. Just anecdotally, for men or for boys who have questions about emunah, there are other things to cling to. There's still minyan to go to and participate in. There's still Talmud to know because you're taught Talmud. And this has, I think, a huge impact on what it means to go off the derech, quote unquote. And I'm wondering if you have personal experiences or just general thoughts about what it means to either speak to boys versus girls, or what questions are that men or women are responding to or are thinking about when they are going off the derech.
Notice now how nobody leaps up now. Yeah.
I can say anecdotally, because I'm not a clinician and I haven't done any double blind studies, but I can tell you that my experience is that there's a higher percentage of young men that leave the fold than there are young women. That's number one. And among there is a significant number of young ladies who leave the fold as well. I think that that because girls have a higher degree of emotional attachment to their families and therefore by extension to the orthodoxy that is practiced by their families, that's why you find girls tend to cling more to the traditions of their families and boys may feel a greater sense of independence. But at the same time, I think that because there are so many factors, as the previous person just mentioned, there's so many factors. There's intellectual factors. There's emotional factors. There's personalities that may have been the cause of the abrasion and the separation. You have to get to the root of the issue, whether you're dealing with a male or a female, and work that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned about Gemara, that boys have the Talmud to cling to, and I'm thinking how many boys are so turned off because they're not connected to Gemara, and they're made to learn Gemara all day long. I wasn't much of a student in high school, elementary school or high school. I really started learning when I was like 16 or so. And we learned Gemara 2 hours a day. In Yeshiva Torah Vadas, mainstream Haredi Yeshiva, in 12th grade, we had Gemara Shir from 9 to 11, and our curriculum, again, in a mainstream Haredi Yeshiva, we were learning Nach and Diktuk excuse me, and Chumash and Navi. We had, so if you weren't good at Gemara, you had two lousy hours. But you had the rest of the day as support. And I've been writing and screaming about this for 15 years already, that I think that the emphasis on more and more and more Gemara is turning away so many children, especially on the Gemara Be'iyun, the Gemara in depth, which really works for a... Honestly, let's be honest, learning Gemara Be'iyun, learning Gemara in depth, is as much a specialty, so to speak, or a specific mind, brain pattern, as would be being good with numbers or, you know, learning physics. It's a certain mindset. There are lots of kids who just, it's just, look, I'm an adult. I find Gemara being, because of my nature, you know, I'm very hyper and all that. I find it very difficult to do now as a 53-year-old adult. And if I'm given shiurim to go, or learning myself, I just don't do it. So I think the fact that, and by the way, it speaks to what the doctor said about being honest and being understanding your children. If you know that you don't have a Gemara learner, you have a kid who is not a Gemara learner, and you're putting him in a yeshiva where they're learning Gemara 6, 8, 10 hours a day, it's a recipe for disaster. You have to be, you know, so the Gemara part, I think, is a challenge to some degree, the way it's being presented in many situations. I think it's very unfortunate that more of a menu is not being offered to the kids. In Tarif Adas, there was even in Bismedrish, Rav Pam had the Smicha Sheir, and that was very good for analytical kids who were boys who were into halacha and bottom lining. And they were, Rav Chazan gave Ian share. But many yeshivas, that's just not being offered now. It's very unfortunate.
So the hour's late. We're just going to have a couple of more. I'm sorry to the people behind, but you can always address people privately. So just a couple more.
I have a Parsha question. And I feel inspired to ask because it all fits in. I don't know why. Ari? This week's Parsha,
let's make it a question.
On a historical point of view, on a historical point of view, Rashi says...
No. Do you have a question?
How do you feel...
Thank you.
How do you feel that one of the commentators, which is Rashi, says 70, 80% of the Jews who were in Mitzrayim didn't go out? They died in the... plague of darkness. So we say there maybe was 3 million people that went out of Egypt, maybe four. So if you multiply, say, 40 million times 0.8 is 3.2. So you got 32 million Jews didn't go on the bus, right. Missed the bus.
Okay,
they were off the derech. Sorry.
No. That's it. You've asked your question. How does he feel about the fact that 80% of the Jewish people didn't lose
Mitzrayim?
These people
did not go out because they were off the derech.
Okay, fine.
How do you feel that the faith community believes that when you're talking about off the derech? It's the topic, off the derech.
I understand
that. And it's this week's Parsha.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
It's a pragmatic, intellectual question. It's not faith. Pragmatic, intellectual.
Right.
How do you feel?
We heard. Thank you very much.
No, so great question, but I don't quite understand it, to be honest.
Don't make him say it again, please.
I would love to discuss this with you after.
No, I don't quite.
We're going to move on now. You have people behind you.
I'm sorry.
There's a question of
fairness. The intellectual question is...
Hello? That's it. Thank you.
You can see me after.
Yeah, I would love to discuss with you after.
See me after. I'll explain.
Please. I would thoroughly enjoy that.
Soon it's going to be next week's Pasha.
I would love to answer. We'll discuss it after, though.
This is the last question.
Okay, thank you. I have a little point for Ari to think about, in that there comes a point when everyone in their own maturity and development, I'm not sure what that magic age is, when you finally realize that some of the people that you look up to and trust and admire are going to fail you in some respects. Parents, you start to see their flaws, you start to see the complexities, and whether it's teachers, whether it's parents, whether it's et cetera. The question I'm getting to is, have we as parents outsourced the education of our children to the school system? And do we need to be not only on top of the whole package, but thinking multilaterally, multidimensionally about our children? And there are limitations what we can do with some of the schools. We've got to supplement, augment as parents. Do we need to also look multidimensionally at each of our children and all of their talents and capacities?
That was the last question.
Just to answer what Jordan, you phrased it beautifully. The answer is yes. Whether it's for better or for worse, we have to know the yeshiva system that we are dealing with. The system that we are dealing with at the present time is not dealing with the bigger picture, is not dealing with theological issues. And if they are, then they may be doing some damage to our children's worldview. And as a result, we do have that responsibility to find ways to engage our children in conversations. And if we may be very surprised, but we have to, it's almost like talking to your kids about drugs. Remember the famous slogan from Walter Cronkite, not talking to your kids about drugs is just like telling them it's okay, right? So not talking to your children about Judaism is almost like telling them it's okay to do whatever you want. We have to engage our kids in these kinds of conversations and not assume that just because they go to shul with us and they go to school and they come to Shabbos meal, that means that they're with the program. Let's engage them. And if we don't feel equipped to be able to discuss certain issues with our children, then let's find someone who can help us.
So just before we close off, last two questions. I just want to remind everybody that the program resumes in the morning. At 9:15, Rabbi Horowitz will be giving a talk, followed right after that by Rabbi Michael Skobach, and then Ari Margolis will wrap it up. So we invite you to come back in the morning. Okay, very quickly.
Yes, my question is to any of the distinguished panelists. How do you counter the fact that a hugely disproportionate number of our most celebrated Jews are atheists? If you go to Wikipedia and look under the topic Jewish atheists, you'll see a whole list. Obviously, Albert Einstein was an atheist. 2 weeks ago, I was reading the London Observer. They interviewed Israeli Nobel laureate Dan Shechtman. He said he does not believe in God. So how do you counter this? This, I believe, is a major issue of our time.
I don't have a problem with it.
I reject the smicha.
I don't counter it as much as make a comment quoting, paraphrasing Rav Kook. I forget which sefer, he speaks about secular Jews and atheists, and how, because Rav Kook in general spoke about things being part of a larger unity and how it all kind of fits together, that we require people who think exactly the opposite, if you think about sort of the world not in pieces but as part of a larger unity and things kind of are necessary for other things. We require people who are secular, we require people who are atheists. I think he was writing for a certain time period, although he doesn't specify for how long, because we require the opposite, the exact opposite of what we believe, to agitate us to be able to get to truth. Because otherwise, if we're only around people who agree with us, we become lazy and we're not forced to dig to get to real truth, to examine ourselves. So this is not a way of talking about the people you mentioned, but to say that maybe there's something about us needing to be agitated, needing to experience the exact opposite in order to get really, really clear on who we are and what we believe.
I think the answer is much more simple. It's Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein had the great brilliant mind of an Albert Einstein, but they don't give out Nobel Prizes for being a Rosh Yeshiva for writing a Gros Moshe. So it's not surprising why great atheists who did not go into the religious system went and had this amazing intellectual energy and found a release for it in secular society. Their contribution has been invaluable. Baruch Hashem, that Hashem gave us such a nation of people who are the people of the book, so that even when we're not, our great minds are not being channeled for Torah, they're being channeled for other great things in the world. Just one last thing. It's not so clear that Albert Einstein was an atheist. No, okay.
Last question.
That the only right way to be is from. Do you believe, and I'd like to address this question to Rabbis Karepkin and Horowitz, that some people are just not hardwired to be from?
I think it's kind of late now. But in Zach McGowan, some lava de Malka.
I'll go next. You go first. Okay. Go ahead.
I would like to suggest that this is, should be a part of a larger symposium. Are people hardwired to be gay? Are people hardwired to be to have all different kinds of social or psychological things that we would perhaps term as undesirable or aberrations and things like that? Are there people in the world who suffer from kleptomania? Are there people in the world who suffer from sexual addiction or alcoholism? Of course. And I think that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in his great wisdom and his great system of justice, is allowed to bring those people into the world, that he can just as easily bring a person into the world who for some reason has a propensity towards disaffection to religion. Absolutely. And yes, there are people who may be hardwired. And it's not for us, therefore, as a result of the validity of your question, it is not for us to judge, but rather to love every single Jew unconditionally.
I think that's a perfect place. I think that's a perfect place to end. I want to say two things. Number one, I again want to thank the Bayit very much for inviting us into your home. And I would like to hear from you if you enjoyed this discussion or you would like to hear other kinds of panel discussions. I would like to hear from you to tell us what we can do at Torah in Motion to serve you. And we thank you very much for coming and wish you a good night.